We've already begun to see special interests mobilizing against change. And that's not surprising. That's Washington. For these are interests that have benefited from a system which allow ordinary Americans to be exploited.
There ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. I got bills to pay. I got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know I can't slow down.
Hello and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm David Kestenbaum in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Chana Jaffe-Walt in Los Angeles today. I'm at NPR West. Today is Monday, June 22nd, 2009, and that was our president, you just heard at the top of the podcast, President Barack Obama, speaking during his weekly address.
Our Planet Money indicator today comes from the World Bank. The number is 2.9%. It is the amount the global economy is expected to contract in 2009. So we're talking about global GDP here, which is a measure of the total economic activity on the planet, and it's projected to shrink by 2.9%. That number is a little worse than the World Bank's previous estimate.
But if you don't like that number, David, you can go around the corner to the optimists at the International Monetary Fund. They are only predicting a 1.3% contraction.
So I called the IMF and I called the World Bank to try and understand the difference, and neither of them got back to us in time for the podcast. But I emailed Ken Rogoff at Harvard, who was the chief economist at the IMF, and he said actually those numbers are not really so different, so far apart, because they use different methods to figure out how to add up the contributions from the various countries. And so they're actually pretty similar if you compare apples to apples. I think the take-home message here is that this year is going to be rough, maybe a little more rough than we thought a few months ago. But I should point out that both the IMF and the World Bank do predict the global economy will grow next year by 2%, maybe more.
Okay. So, David, it's Monday. I know what you're all thinking. You must all be thinking, waking up in the morning and wondering, where is the draft of the regulatory reform legislation? Well, I'm told the Obama administration might release it this week.
So last week we got speeches, we got an outline. We are still waiting for the actual draft of the legislation. And I have a filing cabinet drawer ready for it. And the drawer is labeled important, but not for nighttime reading. So we here at Planet Money, we love documents, but we love people more. And last week I went to try and find some people at the Office of Thrift Supervision. As you may remember, the Obama administration's plan for financial reform calls for eliminating the Office of Thrift Supervision.
And a little reminder, the OTS, it was the regulator that had responsibility for AIG and Countrywide and IndyMac, a bunch of big players that got into trouble in this crisis. And the OTS, observers say, was just not up to the job. It didn't have the right attitude. There's this famous photo from a few years ago where the head of the OTS is posing with a bunch of other regulators, and they have this stack of regulatory paperwork, and all the other regulators are holding garden shears to cut through red tape, and the OTS guy has a chainsaw.
So last week, the morning after the news broke that the Obama administration wanted to close the Office of Thrift Supervision, I went over there, and I stood outside the building, and I tried to interview employees as they arrived. And I have to say, as a reporter, I hate doing this because everyone looks at you like you're some kind of freak.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's not.
Hi, crazy. I'm with National Public Radio. Do you work for OTS? We're just trying to collect people's thoughts on the way to work today.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. When did you find out about the closing?
Oh, actually, I'm not.
Hi, I'm a reporter with National Public Radio. Do you happen to work for the Office of Thrift Supervision?
No, I'm sorry,
okay.
I don't.
Hi, I'm a reporter with National Public Radio. Do you happen to work for the Office of Thrift Supervision?
Yeah, sorry, no comment.
You can't talk?
David, I've been there, man.
I did find this one woman who was willing to talk. Unfortunately, she didn't really have the kind of information I was hoping for. Hi, excuse me, I'm with National Public Radio. Do you happen to work for the Office of Thrift Supervision?
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Fine.
Are people worried about their jobs?
I don't think so.
When did you guys actually find out?
Find out what?
Oh, that the Obama administration wants to merge or do
it. I haven't heard that yet.
Oh, okay. It was just announced last night. So, Hannah, I wasn't getting anywhere, and it was about 9 a.m. So I turned off my recorder, and I was getting ready to come back to the office. And then this man comes up to me, and he sees my microphone, and he says, hello. He says, can I help you? And it turns out he is the head of public relations for the Office of Thrift Supervision. So we went into the lobby and we did this brief interview. Just we'll start with name and title.
William Rewberry, Office of Thrift Supervision Spokesman.
And what do you just have general reaction to the decision to merge or shut down the Office of Thrift Supervision?
Well, at this point, there is no decision. It's a proposal from the administration. And my understanding of the proposal is that under this proposal, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency would be eliminated, the Office of Thrift Supervision would be eliminated, and the two agencies would be combined into a new federal bank supervisor.
And people worried about their jobs here? What's the mood like?
I think it's probably too early to be concerned. I don't think that there are any calls out there for less regulation of the federal banking system or the banking system in general. I think people are used to proposals. There have been many proposals in the past over the years, and we'll just have to wait and see what the final proposal is. As far as I know, there's no concern for anybody to have at this point, and I think anyone who wants to continue to be working in the federal bank supervision area, there'll be plenty of jobs out there for them.
But what's it been like working here with all the criticism?
Well, the agency has received a lot of criticism, I think in large part because our industry focuses on home mortgages and other consumer retail lending. By law, they have to have 65% of their assets in home mortgages and other consumer retail lending. And this economic crisis has started in the home mortgage market. And so it's not surprising that there would be a disproportionate impact on our institutions. So there has been a lot of criticism, our view, and also the failures. We've had some large bank failures. Our view is that the largest banks to fail weren't supervised by the OTS. The largest banks that were allowed to fail were supervised by the OTS. So much larger institutions ran into serious problems and were prevented from failure by the federal government intervention.
I see. So there would have been a longer, larger list of failures that would have not have OTS's name on them had the government let them fail.
Institutions such as Citigroup and Bank of America that are not supervised by the OTS were prevented from failure by government intervention, and they're much larger than Washington Mutual, which is the largest OTS-regulated institution that has failed.
What about the argument that people chose OTS, you know, regulatory shopping, because they thought they were the most lax, easy regulator around?
Well, the example that we hear for that is Countrywide Bank moving to OTS supervision in March of 2007. I think there are two important points there. One is that when we talk about the controversial loans that have been made by lenders, including Countrywide, most of that lending occurred before March 2007. The other important point is that although Countrywide moved to OTS supervision because it was primarily a home mortgage lender, Citigroup moved two charters from the OTS to the OCC, away from our agency to the national bank regulator. The value of those assets was more than twice what the Countrywide was. So really charter conversions have gone in both directions, and really institutions choose the charter that best fits their business model.
What about AIG? It wasn't really a thrift though, right?
AIG owned a thrift, owned a small thrift, and AIG was under OTS supervision on a consolidated basis, although the all of the functional regulators, the insurance regulators, continued to monitor the insurance part of the business, which was the largest by far part of AIG. The part that got of the business that got AIG into trouble, the derivatives, the credit default swaps, was an unregulated product, and that was a decision that was made long ago by Congress that would not be regulated.
Is it true, though, in theory you could have done something about that? The OTS could have.
The OTS had authority. It had limited authority, but it did have authority. We alerted the management of AIG to the risks, and by the time the OTS became the consolidated supervisor of AIG, the credit default swap business ended shortly thereafter. Unfortunately, that risk was already on the books by the time we became the consolidated supervisor.
So the OTS did send out an email to its staff last week after the annoying NPR reporter stopped lurking around out front. And we have that email posted on our blog, npr.org/money. And there's also one there from the acting director, Scott Polakoff. He was the acting director until he was placed on leave in March. And his email explains that he is retiring to pursue opportunities in the private sector.
So that's on our blog. And we also got a lot of really thoughtful comments from you on the blog about a podcast we did where we mentioned that economists in general think that tariffs are bad. So some of you wrote in saying, are they really so bad? Don't they make sense in some situations? So we're going to follow up on that now. And this was, Hanna, in this podcast, you'd gone to the port out in Seattle, and you talked with the guys there whose job it is to determine the duty rates for things that are imported into the country.
Right. So everything that comes in gets taxed, and these guys, they work out of this huge book that they consult for the various duty rates. So they make sure that, say, a car from Korea is getting taxed 4%, and the cow from Canada is getting taxed 2%, and a toothbrush from China is 12%. I'm just making these numbers up. But basically, it's an incredibly complicated system.
And it's spelled out in these huge, huge volumes, these big books that you had the guys throw on the floor to get a sense for how big and heavy they were. But we mentioned in the podcast that most economists think that those tariffs are a bad idea.
Yes, I think ideally we'd like all tariffs to be zero on all commodities, in which case you wouldn't need a book at all.
So there's your economist. His name is Arvind Subramanian, and he's with the Peterson Institute. So just to recap the argument here. So Subramanian says, yeah, he doesn't like tariffs because on average, tariffs are bad for countries. They make everything overall more expensive for everyone.
And we use this example of a toothbrush. So say there's a toothbrush manufacturer in Ohio, and he sells his toothbrushes for a dollar. But also in China, they make toothbrushes, and the manufacturer there, he makes them and can sell them for 50 cents for less.
By imposing a tariff, what you would do is, let's say he would otherwise sell it at 50 cents, the Chinese producer, and let's say you slap a tariff of, say, a dollar, and then it would sell in the United States for $1.50. All those who buy toothbrushes, which is basically everyone in the U.S., assuming that everyone brushes his or her teeth in the morning, everyone has to pay $1.50 instead of 50 cents. So they'd have to pay three times as much as they would have to. And so they have less purchasing power. They're worse off as a result because they can't buy other things because of having to pay more for toothbrushes. So American consumers are worse off.
So a lot of you heard that idea, that argument, and you said, okay, but let's say one reason Chinese toothbrushes are so cheap is that the Chinese manufacturer treats its workers terribly. They have to work in unsafe conditions, or the toothbrush factory pollutes. And then you can argue that that's not a level playing field. There are real costs to the environment, say, and those costs don't appear in that 50-cent toothbrush.
Now you've taken the argument to another dimension, which is that before we were talking about a situation based on pure competition, fair competition, the Chinese producer could sell it at 50 cents and the Ohio manufacturer could produce it for $1, right? Then economics just tells us that the most efficient guy should gain the market. So that's the discussion we've been having so far. But now what you've said is that, wait a minute, there is no such thing as, a free market, because the ability of the Chinese producer to, say, produce at 50 cents could be because the Chinese government is doing some things which is unfair, let's say. Let's take the most extreme example, right? Supposing this were produced by prison labor in China. And because you don't have to pay prisoners anything, that's why Chinese producers can sell it at 50 cents. In that case, I think everyone would agree that's not something that should be allowed, because that ability to sell at 50 cents is based on doing something we all agree should not be done. That's the easy example. But let's go one step further and say, well, let's say, for example, in China, you don't have the right to unionize. Supposing, and say, well, in the U.S., I guess you do have the right to unionize, but let's assume that Chinese workers cannot unionize and American workers can unionize. Supposing the ability to sell at 50 cents is because you can't form unions, workers, labor unions in China. Is that a source of unfair advantage? Now, that's a much more tricky question, because you get into value systems across countries. Some countries might believe that, maybe the right to unionize is not a legitimate demand. Other countries might feel it is legitimate. So by implicitly saying that, we should be allowed to impose a tariff because the inability of Chinese workers to unionize is somehow unfair, then becomes problematic, because then in turn, China could turn around and say that, hey, U.S. companies were getting finance very cheaply, or, you know, Alan Greenspan was maintaining a very loose monetary policy. Now, that's an unfair advantage. What would you say to that then?
I don't know what I'd say to that, Hanna. But you can see from that why we have those huge books listing all the tariffs and why it is so hard for Congress to try to say lower the duty rate on sneakers or something.
And Subramanian says, you know, in general, though, the trend has been that tariffs, they go down. They've just been generally getting smaller and smaller.
Slowly, though, yeah.
Yeah, very slowly.
So we have one final follow-up today, which is on Friday we mentioned that Senator Johnny Isaacson from Georgia got his math wrong when he was talking about the $1 trillion cost of part of the health care reform effort.
If you converted dollars to seconds and you said how many years will it take for a trillion seconds to pass, it's 317,097 years, 11 months, and 2 days.
I did the math, and you and Alex read what I thought was the right answer on the podcast Friday. But just to be sure, I called up the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, and I talked with Tom O'Brien, who is the chief of the Time and Frequency Division. And basically, he works with those super precise atomic clocks that only lose a second in something like 100 million years. So I asked him, I said, a trillion seconds, how many years and days would pass? And he says the answer is that it's impossible to answer that question. He says there are all kinds of strange things going on. For one, the Earth's rotation is slowing down due to tidal friction with the moon. Eventually, he says the moon is going to be stuck up in the sky over a single spot on Earth. He says that part is actually predictable, but there's also magma sloshing around inside the Earth, so he can't tell you a trillion seconds from now that it will be a Thursday. He can't even tell you what year it will be.
You just wanted an opportunity to geek out there, David, didn't you, and talk about magma.
I love the atomic clock, guys.
Okay, I think our time is up for today. Thank you, as always, for your letters and comments. You can email us at planetmoney@npr.org.
We've got those Office of Thrift Supervision emails and an interview with Tom O'Brien about time on our blog, npr.org/money. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Hanna Jaffe-Wolf. Thanks for listening.
When I was a couple hours past and I was sitting in my house, the day was winding down and coming to an end. Taking money from the church, he stuffed his bank account with righteous dollar bills. But even still, I can't say much because I know we're all the same. Oh yes, we all seek out to satisfy those thrills. You know that.